All right, it's time for us to begin, kind of, close enough. We're going to be continuing our study tonight. Our today's lesson is going to be a fairly difficult one from a number of levels, and so I hope that you have kind of prepared yourself emotionally for it. There's going to be some challenging sections of the scriptures we'll look at, some application in the world that's going to be difficult in other levels as well. Before we do so, let's bow our heads together in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the time we are allowed to share together in spiritual things. We hope that as we do so, we are aligned with your teaching, that we're in line with the life of your Son, and that our goal is to walk worthy of the calling for whom we follow. Just watch over our souls. Help us to be wise in response to the attacks of the devil, and help us to be trusting in your testimony and trusting in your Son. This prayer we offer in his name. Amen. All right, so last time we were together, we were closing out some of the aspects of mass media and its influence upon the life of Christians in regards to what we take in. We're now going to focus in on a couple of subsets of that area. Some of them are connected to what we've already discussed. Some of it is relevant in different ways. The best way that we can do it is to simply walk into the water and do our very best not to drown. Because I will suggest to you that in preparation for this material, it's been hard. It's been challenging because of I know Christians who have struggled with these issues in very significant ways. They are heavy and weighty on their hearts. They have changed the course of their lives. In some cases, this subject matter has been the seed that destroyed marriages, that has destroyed homes, and it continues to do so. We're going to start, though, with a broad look at what's going on. When we talk about the subject of pornography, we're talking about more than one thing. Pornography is a subset of behavior. Right now, it is probably more prevalent in America than in other areas, but not exclusively so. And by the way, this is not a modern problem. It's a problem through antiquity. And that means through the first century and even back into the life of the Israelite and before. But it means we have to talk about a broader subject. And that's the subject of addiction from a biblical standpoint. When we talk about addiction, we're talking about the way in which God's designed human body, you and I, interacts in unhealthy ways with the stuff that God has also made. The Bible uses some terminology that we're probably familiar with that is essentially addiction. Some of the terms, and you might want to take note of this, are things like being under the power, enslaved, or mastered. And that's from the text of 1 Corinthians in chapter 6 and verse 12. Those terms are essentially equivalent to the idea of being addicted to something in an unhealthy way. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 4, the term that's used there is stronghold. That something creates a fortress around you because of your attachment to it. Peter talks about it in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 as being devoured by it. And even in the texts that deal with the works of the flesh, the terminologies that are used there, and we'll highlight just one of them for right now, which is in the progressive way in which alcohol influences behavior. One of the terms there is drunkenness. The drunken individual is habitually connected to the impact of the alcohol in their system. For those who have worked in the medical field and deal with anesthesia, one of the questions they ask in the introductory process is if you drink, if you are a regular user of narcotics and such a list. And the very simple reason why is that those who are, the drugs that are used to put you to sleep, they have to give you more. Because it takes more to put you under, and it takes more to keep you under. And you're impacted by them differently because your body's chemistry has changed because of an addiction. It's interesting, and this is a way to think about it. I don't know about you, but all the young people I know, the first time they took a drink of any alcoholic beverage, the response was, "That's horrible." The first time they had beer, the first time they had a liquor, the response was, "That tastes awful." That's like all their responses. And to be fair, in the world, for me, that was my response too. "That tastes horrible." My grandfather gave me my first drink of a Coors beer when I was a late teenager. And it tasted horrible. Is that the same for a lot of y'all's family experiences, Michael? Yeah. And that's a powerful illustration of what's going on. Because if it tastes bad, then why do we go to the second version? Because there's something else, right? There's another factor. And actually with alcohol, there's multiple factors. There's the addictive aspect of it. There's the social impact of it. Everybody else have one? What, are you soft? You can't handle? You can't deal? No, I can't. Like, literally, I can't deal because I don't want to. And I have factors in my own family of history of alcoholism in the blood family that I'm part of that pretty much everyone who drinks in my physical family and makes it a habit and struggles with heavy consequences of it. There's no middle ground. We have sober people in my family and drunkards in my family. Nothing in the middle. So I know me. So even before I was a Christian, I had to learn very quickly that I had a choice to make. Do I want to be the sober people who actually pay their bills or the drunkards who are in trouble all the time? And so before I was a believer, I already came to the conclusion that alcohol and me never should mix. And then I learned more. I learned that there was more information. So, understanding that the Bible addresses layers of addiction in terminology that also includes the spiritual level is really important. Even more so, it's described to us as being, in many addictive behaviors, as deceptive. Just like it tastes bad, but it's an acquired taste. But what you're acquiring a taste for isn't the flavor, it's all the other things. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure that you can make alcohol hiding and stuff, and it tastes fantastic, because they do. The funny reality is nobody starts there. Probably because it costs a lot of money, and most kids are stupid, and so they're the ones who are starting these things. I mean, it's just sequential behaviors. So if it's a deceiver, and there are biblical terms that are equivalent to addiction, which we're using as a broad category, and they are, we have to understand so there's some companions that go along with it. The Bible shows us some things that are good buddies to addictive behavior. Now, we all kind of like to go places with our friends, right? If you want to go to a movie, how many in our culture like to go movies by themselves? It's actually thought of as weird. Of course, at the movies, it's also weird if you're talking, right? Like, those are the weirdness of our culture. Like, at the movies, you're talking, shh, movie's playing. But with my friends. So, in the context of understanding addiction, here are some of the biblical compatriots to addictive behavior. Back in our text of 1 Peter, it's connected with an excessive riot. That's the behavior that follows after drunkenness or excessive inebriation. In Galatians in chapter 5, addictive behavior, both in the Bible and in life, is connected to fornication and adultery. Because almost all addictive behaviors of our context we're going to look at lower inhibitions. They change your understanding fundamentally of the relationships around you. They change your ability to make good choices. Lasciviousness, which is different than licentiousness. That's behavior and unchaste connections and how you touch and interact with people. Have you ever dealt with someone who is coming off of a medically prescribed, they put them to sleep to work on their teeth or something like that? They're not the same person, are they? And they're saying funny stuff, and they're, hey, your face is so smooth. You know, hey, that's literally what they do. They never say that about my face, but other people's faces. I'm furry and fuzzy. So some of those things take place. In addition to that, behavior changes. You begin to lie about yourself in the sense of who you really are or whom you want to be. People deceive themselves in the course of those processes, and your own body, you treat it differently under the influence of addictive behaviors and the desires you have for them. Something to think about that's tied together with this occurs in this: the way in which we value human beings change. Under the influence of addictive behavior drivers, the way you interact with the world shifts because you stop thinking about people as people and you start thinking about them as things. Tools to an end. Well, yeah, that's my grandma and grandpa, but really what they are is the place where I can go steal stuff to get more drugs. Or I can go raid their medicine cabinet for the medicine that's inside of there that they need to keep them healthy, but I want to get high. That's the behavior model of addiction and the way it treats people. They're no longer people anymore. Sexually, that happens a lot in regards to how pornography interacts with this. To apply it to the text we've already mentioned a couple times, this is 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. Let's read that together first as a group reading to kind of get that passage in mind. Jordan, do you want to read before I see you flipping around back there, so you'll get there before I can. So can you get to 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 1 through 4 and read that? All right, so there's a progression in the use of alcohol that's described there that's illustrative of pretty much every other behavior. A lot of times we hone in and say, yes, alcohol bad, don't try it. And that's a right application. But for right now, we want to expand and recognize that what he's talking about there would really apply to any kind of repetitive immoral behavior. The process is the same. Peter is definitely condemning the various levels of drunkenness and inebriation, but the principles apply to everything beyond that too. And so the three terms that are used there that are broken out for us in some translations as excessive wine, revelings, and banqueting are words, when referred to specifically to alcohol use, oinophlugia, kosmos, and potos, that really kind of talk about the various depths of use, from a little bit to a lot. You can think about it in those senses. And they're all dangerous to you spiritually. And the world around us does a thing where they normalize a little bit. They make fun of a little bit more, but then they say a lot is bad. And it really doesn't matter what the behavior is, by the way. Do you notice how that's true? A little bit of immorality, that's fun. A lot, we'll make fun of that. Oh, look at him, he's so drunk. Look at how silly he looks. A lot, oh, you better get some help for that. What we don't recognize is that the behaviors in the little bit create the conditions for the much more, and then you don't know when you've gone to a lot. And most of the folks I've known over the years, of all ages, of all economic levels, of all educational levels, they live a line that says, oh, no, I don't, just a little bit. Except for that one time where I had too much. Oh, and that other time, and that other time. Oh, and back in college when I had, and then on last week at the game. You know, the reality is much different than the presentation that you see there. And so with those three words that definitely condemn one level, which are all certainly identified, we can kind of see the progression of addiction that takes place that goes from use to abuse to dependence. So think about it this way. The way in which this impacts you. Hopefully this will be somewhat visible. If behaviorally, we're talking about addiction and the way it affects the human mind and the way it affects our lives from both a biblical standpoint but also a science research-based standpoint, if the line that is parallel to the ground is normalcy, a normal behavior exists there. The first use of any illicit drug or prescribed drug affects you tremendously. Boom, it hits you. The first time you have propofol, we use the drug that puts people asleep for surgeries and stuff, and for treatments. So the first time you have even aspirin, there's a stronger impact. And then it goes back to normalcy to a certain degree. And so long, the progression goes forward. Eventually, what you notice that happens is the impact of that medication diminishes. And by the way, if you want to test yourself in an innocuous way, raise your hand if you drink coffee or a caffeinated beverage. How grumpy are you if you don't have your caffeinated beverage for one day? What's your grump level? Let me ask your friends and your spouses. Do they bring you coffee to make things better? Like this? And back away? And if it's not coffee, what about just eating? Like if you don't eat yet? You know, like it's noon, you haven't eaten. Here you go. You're hangry. Get a snack. Things are better. You're experiencing the same psychological shift from the first use to the normalcy. And the impact with a mind-altering substance of any kind is more significant because you become dependent upon it and you don't even recognize the dependency creates a change. And so the dosage goes up. One beer doesn't do it. Now I need two beers to take the edge off of the day to have that same thing that happened with one before. And no longer can I drink enough beer to create the edge, so then I go to something else. That's that dependency cycle. And then you reach a point where normalness is perceived on the inside, but you're now addicted and you cannot maintain that normal behavior. And so you either increase the dosage, you ride out the bad times, or you find a stronger substance. So on the outside, if you're watching somebody, you'll see cravings. I gotta have it. You'll see behavior change. You'll see psychological change. Behaviorally, they'll see the world different. Even to the point where addiction can manifest itself in ways that effectively it becomes a person's best friend. And nothing else is important. And you got to have it to feel normal. To make a side point, certain researchers are suggesting that that can be this for you and I. It could be any number of compulsive behaviors. On the inside, especially with mind-altering substances, which, by the way, will include pornography, by the way, when we see those things. You'll make that quick connection. Body chemistry changes. Tolerance changes. Withdrawal effects become magnified. Because in the way that God designed us, there is a way in which we interact to like and to want on a chemical level. It's the interesting thing. How many of you have been to the Coke facility in Atlanta? Just to tour it with your kids or family. How many of you have had the Beverly? How many of you liked the Beverly? Why do you think it is that we don't like it? Because it's not connected to our palates. It doesn't match our foods. But if you're from the area that loves the Beverly and your foods are already that way, you're accustomed to liking it because it matches your expectations. And in fact, you don't like it. I don't want it. They want it again. Even though, to you and I, it is a foul beverage that should not ever have been made. In your brain, there is a tiny portion in the reward center that creates the feeling of enjoyment. And it's actually the same basket of enjoyments that when you win a game. You win a card game. You win a little trivia game. It's the same enjoyment center that if you're having a nice meal or any other natural healthy reward. Even for those of us who play Candy Crush or variations of the game, it's that same reward center. Yes, I finally found the solution to the Tetris map. Got it this time. I got it at level 112. You know, that's the same reward center in your mind. It's also the same reward center that affects a healthy kiss shared between a mother and a child. Or the different kinds of rewards that come into play in a healthy kiss between a husband and wife. They're all part of the same basket. Michael. Right, but as Bill Murray said in one of his movies, baby steps. So all of us are making baby steps to success. Baby steps to the bus, and baby steps so on. Because the goal is to get to a point where it's a tool that doesn't distract us either way, and it returns back to its normal use state, where we're using it for the goal, not for the other thing. Now here's an important fact. The like center in your human form that God has designed has a less significant impact as compared to the want system that your body has. Because here's the illustration of it. You had breakfast. You were not able to have lunch. And now it's dinner time. How hungry does your body feel? It's like, it's eat the horse time, right? You make it to the next day. Maybe you're on a fast for various reasons, and now it's breakfast the next day. Now, the drive to want to eat is stupid. Because things that don't appeal to you start looking good. Like, you know. And someone opens up a sandwich, and you're like, can I smell that? I just want to smell it. You know. Because your want system is so inclined to desire. Now, you might, this is all funny and it's lighthearted because it's intended that way. I want you to understand something. This is the exact way that addiction affects us, even addiction to sin that we know is disgusting to God and to ourselves. The aroma of it drives it just as much as anything else. And we're impacted by it in the same way. And understanding that then helps us as believers strengthen one another. Because we begin to understand why it's so important, our influence. And things that don't seem that big of a deal might actually be a huge deal to someone who is an addict who's recovering after being in a lifestyle of use for 30 years. And something that is nothing to us kind of smells like something to them. Oh, I really need to have that thing again or that event again. But not the Beverly. That's very much true. Right, and all of these things are interacting with a very complex part of how God designed us, which is impacted by our spiritual inputs. It affects our physical choices. You know, we joke about the Beverly because we all have a shared experience for some of us of how awful it is. But understand that that's the process underneath that. You could become accustomed to Beverly and like it. I know that because they sell it places, and people like it. Just like I saw all the other things I don't personally like as my favorites. And people love them. And those are all neutral things. Like Beverly's a neutral thing. You love Beverly? Great. But we're actually using that to teach about things that God is not neutral about. So we can understand some of the risks involved and work in a way that says, this is why it's so important to be careful, to be prepared, and to think through the process before there's a problem, because eventually we're all going to have to deal with it. I mentioned this statistic before. Art Adams, who is a member of the church who preaches up in the Indiana area, he's also a licensed counselor and does addiction abuse counseling. His research has indicated that based on national statistics and his private practice statistics, that 1 in 4 Christian adults struggle with the impact of pornography in their life, whether personally that they're fighting against it on a day-to-day basis, or that their families have been affected by it because someone in their family used it and it created chaos. Pornography became part of a basket of problems. 1 in 4 is a huge number. Let me think about it this way. If I said 1 in 4 for alcoholism, how many of us would be like, yeah, I could see that? Because my upbringing and my life was dramatically affected by alcohol use. I only used a little of it before I got smart enough to go, yeah, I don't want that in life. It doesn't mean that the problem goes away. I still have to understand that the risk is there for me and teach myself to make good choices. But my dad was a recovered alcoholic. He was an alcoholic when I was born. He lost his wedding ring drunk playing pool and gambled it away at a pool house. My grandpa died from diabetes that was induced through his alcohol use. My brother was in multiple car accidents because he was inebriated and drunk and affected a large part of his life. And my other brother has been through, basically his life is defined by drunken partying. So I'm part of the 1 in 4. And I know that's affected me and probably still does. And that's alcohol use. That doesn't even bring in our specific subject, which we're going to get to, which is related. And I'm sure some of you probably live the same struggles, right? Right. Something that is really easy to understand on a technical level, but is emotionally difficult for some folks who are addicted to alcohol to understand, is it does not matter if you drink by yourself in your home or with other people. The spiritual consequences are going to end up being the same. Your soul is still your soul, whether you're with one person, no people, or a bunch of people. And it's probably worse in a crowd than it is by yourself because you're influencing them too. Like we talked about at the beginning, beer tastes bad to almost everybody the first time they drink it. The only reason they have the second drink is because of the alcohol and peer pressure. Well, try this one, it'll get better. Or try that one, you might like it more. Well, try the other 50. It still has that bitter taste that you eventually ignore because the alcohol owns you, in part. And like I said, I'm sure they exist that taste good. Doesn't change the problem. It just changes the vehicle by which the devil gets a hook into your soul. So Steve's right. This is a simple reminder. These contexts are not really just limited to one place or another. And by the way, think about this as a parallel because we are moving our kind of caravan of ideas towards the subject of pornography. Pornography is begun in private. But you know, eventually it affects public choices and behaviors. It eventually rears its head in public. And how do I know this? Just talk to anybody who goes to any kind of public place at any time. There are people who are watching things in your presence that you go, well, I don't want to see that. Office places? Why do you think large corporations ban access to that stuff in the workplace? Because they do. You understand that that's what takes place? Almost every large business has a system in place that says you can't get to that stuff at work. That means people are trying to get there at work. And if it's an open space, that means you're going to see what people are trying to get to, and it affects their work product and their all the other stuff that go with it. And we're going to talk about some of that too on some levels as well. So, going back to this impact of the way it affects in our little chart up here. This is also the impact of your liking and wanting system. And the liking system, the pleasure sensor that rewards yourself for the thing, eventually gets snuffed out because the wanting system becomes so powerful in drawing you to it, and the liking of it becomes less and less. Like, you don't like it as much, but you want it more, or something like it, similar to it. Genesis actually records, and this is our transition point, we've got about 9 minutes left in our class by intent, a distortion of sexuality in the same way. Because our goal is to properly understand the risk of pornography to Christians in any generation. Here are some things just from the text of Genesis that are intertwined spiritually and practically with the challenges of pornography in the modern context. Chapter 4, verse 19, polygamy. Chapter 19, verse 5, sexual activity. Chapter 34, verse 2, fornication and assault or rape. Chapter 38, prostitution. Chapter 38, incest. Chapter 39, evil seduction. I want you to understand that that's in Genesis. That's in the Bible that God wants us to know about as risks. Are those uncomfortable conversations in the household, in the family? Like, you guys want to talk about that stuff? I don't. I'm a dad doing dad-level things. Those are not conversations. That's not like, woo, we get to talk about assault today. None of that. And yet, God needs us to be prepared, aware, and engaging in conversation about it, because that's life. And it's always been life. That distortion of human sexuality then changes the people impacted by it in very significant ways. One of the things that's quite pronounced in this is that the earlier someone is exposed to human sexuality in regards to their human development, it changes the way a person develops. A lot of research indicates this truth, that for young boys and young girls that are prepubescent, that means pre-puberty, if they interact with illicit material, illegal pornography, or whatever you may want to call it, and also sexual material before they would normally begin puberty, that's the day it starts for them. It begins to produce all the chemicals in their body that change their pacing. That's why you have little kids who have been abused who then rapidly begin some of the parts of puberty out of order. Because your body is designed to go through it in a sequence, and it's still weird and awkward and uncomfortable. And so someone who has been abused or shown or engaged in illegal or abusive behavior early, it just changes the order of all those things. And it affects the way they perceive everything else. Trust, a healthy relationship. The conversations that I've had as an evangelist who has been asked to counsel, and I don't really counsel, but I will tell you what the Scriptures teach and what I know. Many marriages are impacted by this. Today, even if the participants in the marriage are holy in their behavior since the day of their marriage till now, because it affects the way they see things. By the way, it's not just the Old Testament. The New Testament makes similar expectations of the contrast between destroyed morality and holy living, often used in even the teaching of Christ. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, Mark 7, verse 21, and so on. You can go through your Bible and constantly see Jesus even dealing with these issues of behavior in the first century. You ever heard anyone quote, "If a man looks upon a woman to lust, he has done what in his heart? Committed adultery." By the way, that is the application of one of the clinical definitions of how pornography affects a person. That literally, the visualization manifests itself in that way. Let's skip ahead for a second and we'll come back. There's an illustration that I want you to think about. Because I'm going to end on a light end. Go ahead. Yeah. Just tear it out. You think about the way in which we allow stuff that's that bad for us to still maintain a presence in our lives. And here's one of the reasons why. And this is, we're getting ahead, but we're going to come back to this where we were in a second. Your mind, as designed by God, is fantastic. It's amazing. There's no computer invented by man that can accomplish the various computations that our brain does in the various ways that we're doing. Yeah, a machine can do some math that we can't do a lot quicker, but we visualize and internalize things super quickly. And we do it in very great, very amazing ways. So, here's my illustration. First thing, do not picture a green elephant with a purple trunk. I don't want you to visualize that in your head. Do not picture a 2-inch clown jumping up and down on the pew next to you. And certainly never picture me with Mickey Mouse ears. Right? So instantly, I can't even look at you now, as if you could look at me before, right? So instantly, the thing